This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Coming up, we look at how the Pacific has reacted to the death of Queen Elizabeth II.
I call on all citizens to remember and pay homage to our late Queen and head of state.
We'll also take a look back and revisit some of the key moments of the Queen's legacy in the Pacific. And Solomon Islands votes to delay the country's national elections to 2024.
The government, it belongs to those ministers only under PM. For us people, no.
First, though, the death of Britain's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, is being felt across the Pacific. Queen Elizabeth is considered to be the most widely travelled head of state in history and met with hundreds of world leaders in her reign of more than 70 years. So how will the Pacific remember the Queen? Our reporter Hugo Hodge takes a look back at her life.
In February 1952, crowds lined the streets of London to hear the announcement of the new monarch.
Publish and proclaim that the high and mighty Princess Elizabeth Alexandra Mary is now, by the death of our late sovereign of happy memory, become Queen Elizabeth II.
Queen Elizabeth II was to become the longest-serving British monarch in history.
Inevitably, a long life can pass by many milestones. My own is no exception.
At the age of 10, she became the Crown Princess when her father ascended the throne as King George VI, following his brother's abdication. At the age of 21, she made a vow.
I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and to the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong.
That same year, she announced her engagement to Philip Mountbatten, and they were married at Westminster Abbey.
Take thee, Elizabeth Alexandra Mary.
Take thee, Elizabeth Alexandra Mary.
To my wedded wife.
To my wedded wife.
They had four children, Charles, Anne, Andrew, and Edward. For a short time, the family led a life out of the spotlight, but that soon came to an abrupt end.
It was announced from Sandringham that the King, who retired to rest last night in his usual health, passed peacefully away in his sleep.
At the age of 25, she stepped into her new role as Queen. A few months after the coronation, Queen Elizabeth made her first visit to the Pacific, travelling to Fiji and Tonga in December 1953. On her second visit to Fiji, she was met by a royal reception.
With no sign of nervousness, 6-year-old Andy Koanilotuma presented a bouquet. She is the great-great-granddaughter of the chief who ceded to Queen Victoria the sovereignty of the Fiji Islands.
Fiji is one of 6 Pacific countries part of the British Commonwealth that once counted the Queen as their head of state. In Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Tuvalu, the Queen remains the head of state. In her 70 years on the throne, the Queen has had a long relationship with the Pacific. In December 1963, the Queen opened the Commonwealth Pacific Cable System.
My voice is being carried through the cable and heard instantly in those 4 Commonwealth countries. Today, a new link has been forged between the peoples of the northern and southern hemispheres.
In 1974, the Queen visited Papua New Guinea when it was on the brink of independence. Barnabas Sorere, a journalist who covered the royal visit, says her presence along with other members of the royal family was important.
Now, this was a very interesting thing because the Queen came to show the people of Papua New Guinea that she wanted these people to be in her family, the Commonwealth. And she came with the royal family to give confidence to Papua New Guineans. To gain independence.
Her last visit to the Pacific was in the 1980s when she toured PNG, Solomon Islands, Nauru, Kiribati, Tuvalu and Fiji. Since then, her children and grandchildren have taken up the mantle to visit the region. The Queen's husband, Prince Philip, died at age 99 in April of 2021. In the months after his death, the Queen's own health faltered and in 2022 had to cancel many of her public appearances. Queen Elizabeth has died as the longest-serving monarch in British history. The Queen will be laid to rest alongside her husband Prince Philip inside St George Chapel in Windsor.
That was reporter Hugo Hodge. Queen Elizabeth made a lasting impact on the Solomon Islands, despite only visiting two times. Prime Minister Manese Sagovare has called for 3 days of mourning next week to commemorate her death, with a public holiday announced for Monday.
I ask all citizens and residents of Solomon Islands not to undertake major events during this period of mourning. Fellow Solomon Islanders, the late head of state of Solomon Islands, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, was the longest serving monarch in the Commonwealth, becoming the Queen in February 1952, and was still Queen at the time of her passing, a period of 70 years altogether. I call on all citizens to remember and pay homage to our late Queen and head of state for Solomon Islands. I invite you all to pray for the royal family at this very difficult time and ask for God's grace and comfort to be with the members of the royal family as they come to terms with this major loss.
Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare there. Former Governor General Nathaniel Wiener was there to greet her on one occasion and later worked directly with the Queen while serving as Governor General between 2004 and 2009. He told reporter Kyle Evans she helped unify the country during its darkest days.
Let me say this, that we live in a world of diversity and complexity. The head of state is a very important figure to have because it represents the wholeness of a nation, all that is to be found in the head of state. Her Majesty has been so gracious an individual, and she has reigned with dignity and with a lot of honor. You can never fully explain who she is, because she is overwhelmingly a personality of very rare nature.
And what was she like to meet in person?
She's got a lot of respectability embedded in her personality. You see her as a person with authority and dignity. And indeed, I count myself as rarely privileged to have been appointed as a representative.
I suppose just lastly, you know, bonds have really been tested in recent months and with talk of, you know, things like China and stuff like that. Do you think the Queen's death, if anything, could have a unifying effect on members of the Queen's kingdom?
It depends on the atmosphere of relevancy that her reign holds, because not so many Commonwealth countries nowadays, territories or countries that the Queen has been the head of state of. And so it will depend upon the kind of reception they accord to Her Majesty. But all in all, I think she has presented herself very well, even to the extent that those who have opted out as republics and have their own head of state still regard her as a very important figure in the family of the Commonwealth of Nations.
And did the Solomon Islands public hold much affection for her?
Indeed, yes. She has become quite an important unifying element in our dark days of the ethnic tension because I was a minister of the crown at that time, and I could feel that although she was in the UK, her influence in Somaliland was still there.
Former Solomon Islands Governor-General Nathaniel Weiner speaking to our reporter Kyle Evans. As news of Queen Elizabeth II's death spread around the region, reporter Dubrovka Volodare spoke to Pacific historian Dr. Kirsty Close about her legacy.
The Queen has had such a long reign that influence has been long-term, and I've heard a lot of people say this morning that because she was in her reign for so long, she was a constant in amongst all the social change, in amongst all the other changes that people have to deal with in their lives. And so I think it's kind of a very human thing just to look for something that is stable and secure, I suppose. But she's definitely been one of those in a vast, quickly changing world. For the Pacific in particular, it's an interesting one because she's been witness to decolonization of several Pacific states, but also still maintained connections with a lot of Pacific countries. So it's an interesting legacy that she has there.
In terms of the more recent relationships, as you've just mentioned, can you maybe pick one or two for our listeners that stand out for you?
I think particularly what she's been quite good at has been to send younger generations, her family, out to the Pacific to build relationships with Will and Harry, that both have travelled around the Pacific, and that's been caused a bit of a stir, you know, like it got, it was exciting for people to see them. But I think there's some tensions underlying it all. You know, the legacies of colonialism are problematic as well. So it's one that I think will take time to fully comprehend. And I think that it's going to be different at a very local village level to what it is at a state level, for example. So the Queen's managed to sort of fly above all of that, be a bit untouchable in some ways to some of that kind of politics.
So almost like a force that's there, that's constant, but doesn't necessarily interfere.
Yes, that's right. And I know there's the whole idea of being like Teflon where things don't stick to you. I think for her, the murkiness of the politics that's transpired over the last few decades she's not been that involved, or it's not tarnished her reputation so much.
And in terms of, you know, getting back to these visits to the Pacific, are there any moments, I'd say, that stand out for you that you could describe?
I've taught on the relationships that Queen Elizabeth had with the Queen of Tonga and the feasts that were shared and how those feasts were really a wonderful time for people to connect with each other. And, you know, there were some very special friendships that she had with leaders from the Pacific over time. And it's a nice time to kind of reflect on the way that she navigated a lot of that space and the monarch-to-monarch connections with Polynesia especially, I think are fascinating.
During her coronation parade in 1953, Queen Salotti very famously rode through the streets of London with an open carriage despite the rain. And I think that's quite a powerful memory, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So I think their friendship and their connection was really exceptional. And I think, you know, for all we can say about, you know, the problems of colonialism and all that sort of thing, sometimes friendship really transcends all of that. And you can see that there was a genuine a genuine respect and admiration that flowed both ways between those two women. And yeah, it's a lovely one to talk about.
That was Pacific historian Dr. Kirsty Close speaking there to Dubrovka Volodya. Now to Solomon Islands, where Parliament has voted to delay the country's national elections by a year to 2024. The controversial move was backed by Prime Minister Manase Sogavare. It comes after Australia was accused of interfering in domestic politics after Foreign Minister Penny Wong offered funding to stage the elections. While the deferment marks a win for Sogavare, not everyone is happy by the change. Chris and Rita Amanu Leong in Honiara with more.
Ensta Toffee voted in the last two elections, but now he'll have to wait a bit longer to vote again after MPs voted to defer the polls by a year.
Government, it's not a government. Government, it belongs to us people. If they view us, they should consider. If they do not consider us, so we don't know. That's the government, it belongs to those ministers only and the PM. For us people, no.
After weeks of political jostling, Prime Minister Manase Sogavare got the support of two-thirds of MPs to change the constitution. 37 out of the 49 members of parliament agreed to defer the elections.
The bill is basically to defer the dissolution of parliament. It does not deal with altering the functions of the Electoral Commission, nor does it set election dates or process, Mr. Speaker.
But young people like Sherlyn Hiru feel that the government is using the Pacific Games to remain in power.
I think the government is using this as an excuse just to stay longer in the parliament. And if this is approved, I think it will set a precedent for upcoming governments.
Solomon's academic Dr. Transform Angorau says the public should recognize the significance of events.
As a government, as a country, we should be able to host any number of major events that would reflect the competency that we have as a country. And we should be proud of the fact that we can actually host not just one, two, three, four, but how many events that we can. The people of this country should be able to mobilize and support.
But Dr. Angorau believes the constitution must be sacred and should not be altered.
We have to be very, very careful about how we address and look at the constitution. The moment we start playing around with the constitution like that, we are undermining, and it's not going to, we're setting a very, very bad precedent for the future of this country.
And Aaron Olafia, chair of the National Youth Congress, says it's a watershed moment and MPs must accept responsibility for their actions.
Every young people in Solomon Islands are watching the current issue, and I feel that probably the government is doing what they feel it is right. And they're not watching to do something that is illegal, but like for future instance, if they should become parliamentarians, what would they do?
Arian Olufia, chair of the National Youth Congress in Solomon Islands. The reporter there was Chris and Rita Amonu Leong. Scientists have found the songs of humpback whales in French Polynesia can travel thousands of kilometres all the way to Ecuador in South America. Sydney-based wildlife scientist Dr. Vanessa Perotta explains why this new finding is so special.
In the whale world, at least for the humpback whale world, it is widely known that the male humpback whales will sing these repetitive songs and that are socially learnt and also transmitted between different cultures. And it is the males that sing to generally attract the females. So the females don't sing. So that's the first thing that people should be aware of. But what's really cool about this new research is that we knew that songs from the East Australian East Coast population spread eastward into areas like French Polynesia. So we knew that essentially what one whale was singing this year was likely to be spread across the basin in another year, or at least maybe the same year. So that was one thing. But what's really cool is that recordings and different recordings of different whale themes recorded in 2016 and 2018 in French Polynesia actually match the song themes sung in 2018 in Ecuadorian waters. So this suggests, and this is the key point of the paper, is that the transmission of song from Australian East Coast is able to go all the way to Ecuador. So this vocal connectivity, as it's called, is actually fulfilling the entire South Pacific Ocean basin, which means that song, not only did we know it was incredibly important in the whale world, but is now being transmitted further than we even thought. So it's absolutely incredible.
And is it almost like a language?
Yes. So whale song is incredibly important for whales because, you know, they're in an environment that is quite large. They can't always see each other face to face or eye to eye or flipper to flipper. So sound is incredibly important and a main way of communicating to each other. So whales have developed, or at least use, at least the humpback whales, the baleen whales or the toothless whales, are able to use low frequency sounds. Which travel a lot further in the ocean. So this is like you and I having a conversation from the middle of Sydney to the eastern suburbs of Sydney just by, without a phone, just, you know, using sound and allowing the ocean to transmit that low frequency sound and that song, in this case, across large geographical distances.
Would we be able to discern the differences or to differentiate it?
One of the ways we can learn more about humpback whale song, the songs that males sing, is by recording this through underwater hydrophones and then visualizing the song. So while we are able to hear the sound of whales, which suggests that we have similar hearing to what they do, there might be slight differences that we might not be able to pick up on. So this is where visual or audio tools will really be helpful so we can visually see these differences. And if you can see the way a song looks rather than sounds, and then you can match that to other areas where a song is recorded there, then that can really help us have this visual understanding that, hey, you know what, they're singing similar things. Maybe, just maybe, the song that's been sung in the East Australian population has travelled all the way over to Ecuador, and then what we do have in this study is showing that, which is really cool. So essentially, humpback whale song that starts in Australian waters continues to spread beyond French Polynesia and into central South Pacific to the Ecuadorian breeding grounds, which is so cool.
And does it mean that it will change from year to year?
Yes. Humpback whale song is known to change slightly from year to year. So the way I put it to the general public is what is a hit in one year is likely to be a not a really cool hit song the next year. And that makes sense because, you know, you want to sound, as a male, you want to sound fit, strong, and you want to be a new thing on the block, essentially. And in the whale world, I'm without anthropomorphizing that too much. It would make sense that the song will change slightly to advertise that, hey, it's a new year potentially, and this is what I sound like, and I sound pretty healthy and pretty big. I'm a big male. I'm ready. I'm here, and I've got good genes to spread.
And what does this research mean? What sort of impact do you think is it having?
This research really does demonstrate that song has the ability to travel huge geographical distances in terms of being spread. So I'm not just talking about there's one thing that sound travels really far in the ocean. That's one thing. But the potential for song to be transmitted through different populations, through cultural transmission, and highlights the fact that vocal culture is really prevalent in Southern Hemisphere humpback whales is really important. It shows us that, well, hold on a second, we would think that one population is doing one thing, but we need to think bigger and more geographically widespread to try and understand just how far whales and their vocal abilities are able to embed into other populations. So this is one way of connecting whales in one part of the world with another through the use of sound and song.
Wildlife scientist Dr. Vanessa Perotta speaking to Dubravka Volodar. And that's it for now from Pacific Review. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Thanks for listening, and do join us again the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.